When I started my PhD, my supervisor tried to convince me to get out of this, the idea of working on larvae of Hadrodifaga. And at that time, my argument was that even though people believe that this is a dead end, that might be because nobody found the good characters to work on the larvae. And I think that in a symposium like this one, if there is one take-home message that would be sent to younger people, it's always to try to find new features. And this is what I'm going to try to show you today. It's a kind of a story where I'm going to give you an example of how larvae was helpful to demonstrate that the larvae can complement or even give new direction in understanding the phylogeny of Hadrodifaga. So I'm going to start with some basic information very quickly for sure, just to tell you that while there are four suborder in the Coleoptera, and one of the most diverse is the suborder Hadrodifaga, which is comprised mostly of predaceous beetle. Now, for a matter of convenience, Hadrodifaga are divided into two grouping, the terrestrial one, which are called Hadrodifaga, which is comprised mostly of carabid, and two minor family. And there's a bunch of about 5,500 species which are adapted to live in the aquatic medium, and they are called Hadrodifaga. And this group is actually including quite a few different families. One of the most diverse is the family Geranidae, which is the really good beetles. You have Halipolis, small groups, which is very unique among Hadrodifaga, being algivorous. Noterid, which is a mainly tropical and neotropical group of beetle. And Physoid, small group made of six species, four of them found only along the western coast of North America in the Rockies. Hygrobid, another small group, which is comprised of four Australian species. Of course, the Itisid, which actually is is comprised of the bulk of Hadrodifaga, which is one of the most diverse aquatic insect family. And two minor family, Aspidotidae, which has been discovered only recently, 6 years ago, which is now comprised of two species, and even more recently, Meruidae, which is made of only one species. Okay, as you know, Coleoptera are holometabolous insects, which means that the larva is quite different from the adults. I will give even more other arguments in favor of why studying larval morphology, just to echo what we heard earlier this afternoon. Well, holometabolous insects are neat because larvae represent a different expression of the same genotype of adults. Increased knowledge of larval characters is necessary to help clarify and to complement adult characters, which have been the primary basis for insect classification. And larvae are unknown in spite of the fact of their utmost important role in the life history of the insect. So why people are not studying larvae? Well, there are some constraints when you study larvae. One of those being that they are seasonal, they often occur over a brief period of time. You have multiple instar, which complicate the comparison among the larvae and make the job a bit longer. And the association with adults is very problematic. And species level characters are deemed to be very difficult because the larvae are generally very similar morphologically. Okay, one of the big chances I had in my career was to try to take another approach, whereas most people are trying to associate the larvae with the problem that this can cause. I had the idea to try to rear the larvae from the eggs, which is more demanding but very helpful, because when you do that, you have access to good quality specimen. You also get a very safe identification because you know the parent, and you get early instar. When you deal with the larvae of about 1 millimeter long, you can imagine that it's very difficult to collect them in the field. And you get also additional information, like I take measurements of rate of development of egg, larval instar, and all that stuff. Now, the big question is, are larval characters more subtle than in adults? Well, my big chance was to study a new character system, which is the study of city and pores, which what we call generally ketotaxy. And this is what actually provided me with quite a few interesting characters, both from a diagnostic and also phylogenetic perspective. Just to provide you with some wording that I'm going to use in my presentation, my system is made of two kind of city. I differentiate the primary city and port, which are those found in the first instar. And those cities are themselves divided into what I call ancestral, which are the city found everywhere in the Adephaga, and additional, which are some city which are all only found in some lineages. The neat thing is that the primary city are distinguished from the secondary city, which are added throughout the ontogenetic development of the larva. And this provides such a wide array of characters, as I will show you. Just to exemplify that, I'm going to use just the legs of members of the subfamily Hydroporani, which is what the most diverse subfamily of Dyticidae. So in my system, every city is coded by two capital letters, which refer to the article where they are found, and a number, which is for the city. The ports are coded in a similar way, except that the numbers is changed for a lowercase letter. So this is the ground plan pattern of primary city on the legs of the Hydroporani. And believe me, it's very stable. There's only a few variation among taxa. Now, if you look at this pattern for the primary city, I'm going to show you some species, some later instar of other species, and you're going to see the difference. So just try to keep in mind this pattern. So in this first example, for example, you will recognize that you have some spine-like secondary city which are added. The tarsi don't have any secondary city, but you have some. If you compare this one with the following one, well, you see that the numbers of secondary spine-like cities is way larger. And now you find them on tarsi, which provide additional information. Look at this one now. Well, you have quite a few secondary spine-like city, but in addition to that, you have those elongate hair-like city, which are deemed to play a role in the swimming propensity, and they are called natatoricity. They are found, in this case, along the dorsal margin of the tibia and tarsi. Compare this one with this other one. You see? Quite a few secondary spine-like city, and a huge numbers of natatoricity, not only in tibia and tarsi, but also in femora. And look at this South America group, Tachydrus. Natatoricity are along the ventral margin of the femur, a very unique feature. So you see already quite a few interesting characters which are very useful for all kinds of questions. Okay, so just to give you an example of how this was helpful for the in the various examples. So the Hydroporani is one of the most diverse subfamily of Dyticidae. It's made of 8 tribes, and the numbers within parentheses is the numbers of genera. And one of the most diverse tribes is the Hydroporani. I've been working on this group in particular since about 20 years now. When I started working on the Hydroporani, there was 2 genera, Agrotus and Hydroporus. These two were a dead end. Nobody were able to differentiate even a 13 star. So I start working on this group, and I'm going to show you the last abdominal segment. And those larvae have an elongate structure, which are called erigonphi. In this group, they are made of 2 articles. The ground plan pattern of city and pores on the erigonphi is made of 8 city. We have 7 represented, but you have the city number 8. I was very interested to look at the position of this particular city. In Agrotus, I found that this city is always articulated at about mid-size of the second erigonfomere. And interestingly enough, in Hydroporus, it's always apical. For the very first time, somebody was able to differentiate these 2 genera. So I started working even more in Agrotus, and I did find that all the Agrotus as first instar can be distinguished from Hydroporus by the presence of the primary pore E on the parietale. And all these species have also the primary seta 5 on the maxillaries type. So we see already 3 characters that helps to discriminate these species from Hydroporus. So a little bit later, I came with a provisional phylogenetic analysis, including some genera of Hydroporani. And what I did found or suggest that all these genera are Hydroporani, and Agrotus is actually different from those guys. And I came to suggest that this Agrotus may be part of a tribe called Agrotini, along with these other genera. This was not new. It was the first time that somebody came with a cladistic approach to demonstrate that, but some taxonomists were suggesting that, based on adult morphology, that this could be possible. Okay, at this point, we had some argument. I was lucky enough to get offered something, the opportunity to work on Aerophrygis musicus, a Canary Island species, which is, according to this hypothesis, part of the Agrotini. My very first thing was to look at the feature, and look at what I see. What I got the primary pore, like Agrotus, I got the primary SEDA MX-5 like I grew this. And if you look at the position of the primary SEDA MX-5, UR8, it is located at mid-size, of the secondary gun from air. So, argument in favor of this idea that these guys are part of another tribe, I grew tiny. And even more recently, I came with a more extensive analysis, a study which actually include the larvae of all eight tribes of Hydroporini. And in this study, one more time, one of the most well-supported clad was this one, where you have Aerophidrus and Igrotus. And I was interested to actually observe in the recent paper published by Ignacio Ribera and collaborators, published in Cladistic a few months ago. Ignacio came with a very extensive analysis of the Adaita city using a molecular approach. And one of the branching he got actually was this one, which is actually strongly supported. And you see that Aerophidrus and Igrotus is actually well supported, something that we got from the larvae. So an additional argument for usefulness of that. Okay, who cares, right? I've had that question so many times. And actually, at the earliest stage of my career, some evening in my lab, I was asking to myself, who cares? Who cares? Why are you doing that? I was sometimes wondering if I was the only one interested by that. Well, I proved to be wrong, because actually, there were quite a few individuals all over the world who are stuck with their larvae. And they got interested to apply the system I was using. And I'm listing only a few collaborators here to tell you that I now receive larvae from all over the world, which is very interesting because then I have an opportunity to test my hypothesis. Now, the reason why I'm showing that is just to point out one particular guy, David Bilton from the UK. And David gave me one of the most interesting opportunity in my career, which was to study the larval morphology of this new family, Aspidotidae. Which has been discovered only a few years ago. Well, just to remind you the situation, not everyone agree on that, but Hydrodiphaga, people are wondering, are they monophyletic or not? It's not clear yet. Most people agree that you have three lineages in this group, Gerinid, Haloplid, and this group, which is actually representing the superfamily Dytiscoidea. Up to the discovery of Aspidotidae, there were only four families in this group. Okay, so I'm just showing you quickly again Aspidotidae. There's two species worldwide, one from South Africa and one from China. And when the first discovered the Niobe, Ignacio Ribera and collaborators came with a first phylogenetic hypothesis based on molecule. And in this hypothesis, he suggested that Aspidotidae was actually Dytiscoidea and was probably sister of the Agrobid and Dytisid. Okay, so here you have represented where this larva or this species is found. It's a very, very strange species because it is found on the surface film of water. So it's a mediculous species. And I like to think that this may express a kind of transition from the terrestrial habit to a more aquatic habit. I believe that, not everyone do, but this is what I think. Just keep that in mind. So, just to show you the larva is a typical Adephagan larva. So in order to study the phylogenetic signal of that larva, what we did, we sampled over all the major families of Adephaga, and then we conducted an analysis. And what we got from this analysis is actually six most parsimonious tree. All six are in support of a monophyletic origin of Aspidotidae and order Dytiscoidea. So this confirmed what we got based on molecules. Now, the interesting thing with those three is that four of them show that Aspidotidae should be more basal within the Dytiscoidea, more basal than what is suggested by the molecules. And even in the remaining two, they are even more basal than what the molecules tend to suggest. Okay, what do we get from that? Like in terms of supporting the monophyly of this group, Dytiscoidea, including Aspidotidae, are actually suggested to be monophyletic by the reduction of the nine abdominal segment, or even its absence. These larvae are also unique among Adephaga by the presence of the primary pore PAE. And if you look at the legs, now you have an interesting feature. those larvae have four primary cilia, 7, 8, 9, and 10 on the femur, which are not found anywhere else in Adefaga. And finally, if you look at the maxilla, they don't have a lacinia. Okay, now the question remains, are Spidactylus sister to order Dytiscoidea? I tend to believe that they might be, and for the following reason. There's a kind of evolutionary trend in the shape of the last abdominal segment. In carabids, we have 9 abdominal segments. In Aspiditis, you have a reduced 9 abdominal segment, whereas in the Dytiscoidea, you only have 8 abdominal segments. So evolutionary trend, which may suggest a kind of transition towards a reduction of the number of the abdominal segments. This trend is supported by other trends. If you look at the cetacean of Dirigamphi, well, carabids are characterized by 9 primary cilia and 6 primary pores. Now, the ceta 9 and the pore D, E, and F are also found in Aspiditis. But all these 4 sancilla are lacking in Dytiscoidea. Again, some suggestion that it might be Aspiditis diverged earlier than the other Dytiscoidea. Look at the mandibles now. Carabids and Aspiditis have a tiny structure called a retinaculum, which is very generalized among Adefaga. This structure is lacking in Dytiscoidea. And finally, one of the most interesting structures is probably the trochanter. So you have here represented the legs of these 3 groups. And all 3 have a trochanter, which is a normal shape, but Dytiscoidea are different for that particular reason. There is a breaking line on the trochanter, which is a trochanter annulus. And my suggestion is that this represents an evolutionary trend toward an adaptation to live in an aquatic environment. You have to keep in mind that for an aquatic larva, the leg is like a row. So if you have to push, the pressure is likely to be at the narrowest part of the legs. So if you are very stiff, you're going to break your legs. You have an advantage to have a breaking line, which provides you more flexibility. On top of that, if you look at the cetacean, anyone will agree that the more cetacean you have, the more you're going to enhance your swimming propensity, right? So if you look at the secondary cetacean of Aspiditis don't add secondary cetacean. The leg of the first instar is similar to the leg of the third instar, except for these 3 secondary cetacean. Whereas in Dytiscoidea, you used to have quite a few secondary cetacean. So I think this suggests that you have a kind of evolutionary trend towards like a better swimming propensity that you don't have in Aspiditis. So this is another example. Now, quickly, because my time is running, this is a paper I'm working on, which revealed to be a very stimulating. Not at first, now, but now it is very stimulating. It deals with 2 genera found in Australia. And the interesting thing is because we are dealing now with subterranean Hydroporion. So I'm still working on it, but just to show you what I got so far. So the genus Pyrostera is an endemic Australian species. So it's part of the Hydroporion. And based on a recent study, there was 11 EPGN species, all found in Atlantic shallow ephemeral water bodies in southwestern and southeastern Australia. So if you look at some species, what you should keep in mind is the overall similarity of all these species. Okay, Neuropyrtae now. Neuropyrtae is another genus from Hydroporion. It's actually made of about 35 species, and they are interesting because they are blind subterranean diving beetles, and they are found from concrete aquifers in arid areas of Western and Central Australia. Now, if you look at the morphology of adults, you see that they are quite different. Like the species A is Pyrostera coraggiae, and the other species are Neuropyrtae. Anyone would agree that those Neuropyrtae don't look as a Pyrostera, and even as a Neuropyrtae, they are quite variable. So, I was offered an opportunity to work with this group because recently, Chris Watt suggested that Neuropyrtae might be a junior synonym of Pyrostera, and he came with a study based on molecule, and it was strongly supporting the idea that Neuropyrtae belong to Pyrostera, and this was almost 100% support to this node. So I was offered the opportunity to work on the larvae. I was a bit reluctant anyway, but anyway, I just looked at the larvae. You have here represented the head capsule of Pyrostera michelsoni. I could have taken any other EPGN species. They all look the same. When I looked at them, I said, no way, I won't be able to get anything from those larvae. And I start looking at the larvae of a subterranean species, and look at the diversity in shape. This is just amazing. And I said, no way, there's no way that those Neuriprotae are synonym to Pyroster. And I was sure about that, up to the moment where I start looking at the labium of the larvae. And I'm showing you the larvae of Lacornellus. This is to show you that in Adephaga, the labial palpomer is made of two palpi. Well, I start looking at Pyroster, and I was amazed by the fact that they have a palpus made of three palpomeres. I've never seen that in 20 years, so I just said, wow, how is it possible that this occurs? So my first reaction was, okay, let's have a look to Neuriprotae. Guess what? They have a palpus made of three palpomeres. So this is a strong synapomorphy. So in conclusion, what I have to say at this point is, yeah, obviously Neuriprotae is a junior synonym of Pyroster. Obviously Pyroster have evolved a large range of aberrant character state in contrast with the narrow range of morphology seen in the pigeon species. And I think that, not a conclusion, but a lesson I got is adaptation to a subterranean way of living may be surprising. And as my little daughter told me, you should have known that because you're a fan of Lord of the Rings. And thank you.